Good morning. This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Inequality in the United States is the stuff of headlines these days and has been gaining more attention in the years since the economic collapse of 2008. But the gap between rich and poor in America has been steadily increasing for decades before that crisis occurred. The statistics are startling, including this. The one family that owns Walmart has as much wealth as the bottom 40% of the U.S. population. That's some 120 million people. That is just one of the examples found in a book by journalist Hedrick Smith called Who Stole the American Dream? And he'll be discussing the causes of inequality chronicled in that book this week at the University of Vermont. Hedrick Smith joins us now on the line. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Mitch, a real pleasure.
Now, it's no secret that wealth inequality is growing. It's even the chief reason that Vermont's junior Senator Bernie Sanders has pointed to for exploring a presidential bid in 2016. Your book discusses the mortgage crisis, predatory lending practices by banks, but it also says the roots of this present-day financial inequality can be traced back to the early 1970s. What happened then to push us to where we are now?
Well, what's interesting, Mitch, is that a lot of people say the middle class is in trouble and there's high inequality of income because of globalization, because of advancing technology, because of market forces. There's nothing human beings could have done about it. We just all have to sort of turn up our coat collars and live with it. And I kind of believed that before I started working on this book, Who Stole the American Dream? But when I got into it and got tracing back in the history, I found out that there were two things that happened that were really important. One was there was a power shift in Washington, and the other was there was a real change in the mindset of business leaders in this country about who should benefit from the gains and the profits of American growth. We got into the ditch because a guy named Lewis Powell wrote a manifesto for corporate America back in 1971 before he got put on the Supreme Court and said, business, you've got to organize, you've got to take power, you've got to go after your enemies aggressively. And business lobbies today outspend labor lobbies 60 to 1. They outspend consumer lobbies 100 to 1. They outspend the environmental lobbies probably even more than that. There was a belief in the bosses back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that they should share the wealth, that that was good business, that was smart economics, the country would grow, their companies would profit if they paid their workers well. And now what we have is what you just described a moment ago, the Walton family, four heirs of Sam Walton. By the way, they don't work. All they do is clip the coupons and reap the dividends, and they're four of the 11 wealthiest people in the country. They own more wealth than 40% of the population. We have to understand that and the roots of that.
Well, it's not as if Americans aren't aware of this inequality, but one of the things you discuss in the book is the Occupy Wall Street movement, and you said that's evidence of people starting to fight back, but nothing really came of that effort to bring about real change. What do you think has to happen to shrink this gap between the haves and have-nots?
In terms of Occupy, they actually did achieve something very important. If you say to people today, the 99% and the 1%, people get it, and you can thank Occupy for that. What they didn't do is do what those other earlier movements did, which was to articulate goals, to have a leadership. I mean, if you ask Martin Luther King and Andy Young and John Lewis what they wanted in the Civil Rights Movement, they wanted to drink at those drinking fountains, they wanted to sit at those lunch counters, go in the good restaurants, and have a shot at the jobs. If you asked Occupy, they couldn't tell you if they wanted to limit the size of the banks, put a ceiling on CEO pay, impose a tax on stock option transactions in order to fund some of the social programs and cut down the inequality of wealth, raise the minimum wage. They had no agenda. So, I mean, part of what we have to do is to have an agenda, and then we have to get active.
And don't elections matter, too? Because one of the things that you point out in the book is that in 2010, Senate Republicans sided with corporate CEOs on calls to preserve the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. Now, many of those Republicans were Tea Party members. They were voted into office during the midterms that year. And Republicans now, they're poised to retain the House. There's a very strong possibility that they'll gain the Senate as well. If that happens, regardless of which party wins the White House in 2016, is there going to be any change because of that resistance, at least that we're seeing now from very conservative members in the House, to getting rid of things like tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans?
Well, absolutely elections matter. Of course they do. But what people need to understand is the day after the elections, the lobbyists in Washington go to work to undo the elections. In 2012, Obama won by 3.5 million votes. The Senate Democrats managed to add to their seats, two seats, instead of the Republicans taking over. And more people voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives than voted for Republicans, but Republicans wound up with a 33-vote majority. Now, mostly that's because of gerrymandering of districts. In Pennsylvania, Democrats outvoted Republicans, but Republicans got 13 seats and Democrats got 5. In North Carolina, the same thing happened, and Republicans got 9 seats and Democrats got 4. Now, the gerrymandering is done in Massachusetts and Connecticut by the Democrats, and they do it to their advantage. But this is distorting our elections. We're going to have gridlock, regardless of the outcome of these elections, until we fix gerrymandering. I'm not saying people shouldn't vote. I'm not saying they shouldn't be engaged. Of course they should. But there's a great tendency in this country to feel as though voting and elections are sufficient, and after that you can go back to what you were doing and not paying attention. The lesson of our history is that is not the case. You've got to stay engaged. You've got to keep pushing for the positions you want. You've got to keep pushing for reform, and people need to get organized.
And it's really not a Democrat-Republican thing either. I think I'm hearing what you're saying, because if you look at something like the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which, of course, you know, allowed investment banks and regular banks to sort of mix their business, that was repealed under the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I mean, both parties, in terms of how we got to where we are, both parties bear responsibility. It's not, I mean, the biggest change is my big surprise in reporting on this book, Who Stole the American Dream, was that the biggest changes started under Jimmy Carter and the Democrats in 1978-79. That's not what most people think. That's not what I thought before I started the work. But yeah, you're right. Both parties have gotten involved. Both parties have been largely captured by wealthy financial interests. And a guy like Bernie Sanders is sort of standing outside of both of the parties. He does caucus with the Democrats, but he stands to the side and says, you know, we've got to do more. And there are a lot of other people that think the same thing. I mean, Bob Reich in that movie, Inequality for All, captures a lot of the things that I'm talking about in my book, which is how deep and how long-term the inequality has been. And if we don't make fundamental changes in our political and economic system, we're going to continue to have it. Voting isn't going to get it out of there. We've got to vote, but that's not enough. We've got to do more.
Hedrick Smith, you are also so well known for two of the most seminal books ever written about the Russian peoples, The Russians, its follow-up, The New Russians. I must ask, with everything going on in Ukraine these days, do you think Vladimir Putin is willing to risk war and go ahead and try to annex Ukraine?
Well, I think you need to understand Vladimir Putin is playing in his backyard. He's acting like a Russian czar. The Russian czars have always wanted to control the area right around their borders. They've been tied to Ukraine for over 1,000 years. So the links between these two countries are old, old, old. And what I think Putin has been worried about is that somebody's going to draw Ukraine into NATO. And what's NATO? NATO's an anti-Russian alliance. And yeah, I think Putin says, this is my backyard. I find it hard to believe that you all the way over on the other side of the world are going to go to war to protect this area here. And there are a lot of Russian speakers and Russian people in eastern Ukraine, and they want to be part of Russia, and we can foment trouble there. I mean, he shouldn't be behaving the way he is. But we've provoked him by pushing the borders of NATO right up next to his frontier. So he feels surrounded, and he's lashing out. He's a bear trapped in a cave. So we got to figure out how to de-escalate this, and it's very difficult now. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle.
Hedrick Smith is a journalist and author of Who Stole the American Dream? He'll be speaking at the University of Vermont Tuesday afternoon at the Davis Center. You can find details at vpr.net. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Mitch.